Underworld, Disc 25.
Chapter 6. The empty lot was less than a block from the school entrance. A rambling waste with a higher and lower level, boulders, weeds, and ruined walls. Signs of old exploded garbage here and there, brown bags tossed from adjacent buildings. And this is where young kids had rock fights, and older kids roasted sweet Mickeys in the evening chill, and where a kid named Skeezer ate a grasshopper live, which was a legend of many a neighborhood, the kid with grasshopper juices running down his chin. But in this case, there were reliable older men who'd witnessed, and where other and darker stories were set. A man who slept in a ditch every night, and the guys from the other pool room, majors, taking a girl into the ruins, late, a summer night, and lining up for sex. And who was the girl, and was she willing? And other stories of the lots. It was a single expanse of land that was called the lots, the way a back alley was called the yards. And this is where Matty got his hand busted up, in a card game called Shots on Nux. He walked in the apartment and went into his mother's bedroom, where she was doing her beadwork, and he stuck the hand in her face. "What's this? What does it look like?" he said. "Blood. Then that's what it is. Then you should go and clean it. Don't you want to know what happened?" "What happened?" "Never mind," he said. He sat in the living room and examined the marks and scrapes, the mudlit streaks of dried blood. He felt a self-pitying pleasure doing this, even a fascination, an animal attachment just short of licking. But then his brother walked in the door earlier than usual, and he tried to conceal the hand.
"What's that?"
"Nothing.
Show me, jerk."
"I just need to clean it."
"You need to put iodine on that. Let me see."
"I don't need iodine," he said with a soft insistence.
He extended the hand and looked away at the same time, sort of tactfully.
"He needs iodine," Nick said to their mother. "Is that the 7-Up man?" "Iodine, iodine."
Manny went small in his chair as his brother looked at the hand. Nick's own hands were dirty and bruised, and so much bigger, 5-6 years bigger, a man's hands almost, blistered on the palms and cut by broken glass.
"How'd it happen? You punched a little girl in the mouth?"
"Card game in the lots."
"You go in the lots?"
"Just at the edge."
"Does she know you go in the lots?"
"I don't go way in."
"You think it's a good idea, going in there?"
"What do you think?"
"I think go in, but watch yourself. There's kids in there from all over. They don't know you're my brother."
Nick held his hand and looked at it.
"It doesn't hurt the way it did."
"You played shots on the Nux."
"That's right."
"And you ended up holding some cards, and the winner whacked you how many times?"
"I had a choice.
I remember this choice.
Either he gives me 9 scraping shots with the edge of the deck, or he gives me 4 scraping shots and then 1 killer shot with the deck held up and down.
Blunt end, where he hits you square in your knuckles, full force."
"That's right,"
Matty said.
"Let me ask. How could you lose a kid's card game, a brain like you, supposedly, playing with a bunch of little pisspots?"
"They weren't so little," Matty said.
Nick held his hand. Many times through the years, Nick had bopped him on the head, a flick of the middle finger that carried slingshot force. Many times Nick had lifted him off a chair and sat himself down. Nick had held him out the window once for rubbing snot on a door edge. Many times Nick had booted him in the ass for no reason except he was passing through a room that had Matty in it.
"I think we're talking about iodine here."
"I don't need iodine,"
he whispered. He looked at his hand in Nick's. His brother had an odor of work and heat and sharp salami, the spicy, bright salami he ate on the job. Their mother came in and looked at the hand. She said,
"Mercurochrome."
Nick took the hand away from her.
"Iodine," he said. First he washes the hand with soap and cool water. Matthew, are you listening? Then he dries the hand. Then he puts iodine on it.
I don't want the iodine, Maddie said. I want the mercurochrome.
Iodine, it's stronger, it's better, it's hotter, it burns.
Mercurochrome, Maddie said.
It eats right into the wound, cleaning and burning.
Mercurochrome, Maddie said.
But he didn't want his brother to drop the hand, to let go of the hand, just yet. Clara stood on the roof, watching storm clouds build bluish and hard-edged, like weather on some remote coast, a sky that seemed too lush and wild to pass this way. The child played with the neighbor's child on a blanket nearby. She had taken down the laundry and put it in the basket, but wasn't ready to go inside just yet. The wind was gaining force, and she could see women on rooftops all up and down the block, unpinning clothes from swaying lines, ducking under bedsheets, walloped up. And she could hear other women pulling on the lines that crisscrossed alleyways between windows and laundry poles, the screech song of old ropes passing through the grooved rims of all those rusty wheels. She missed Albert's mother. It was strange to walk into the front room now, an awkward, empty place. First the empty bed, and now not even the bed, just floor space that needed filling. It was also strange how they hadn't wanted to get rid of the bed, either one of them. They'd kept it around for weeks, cranked to her daylight angle, the hours when she liked to close her eyes and feel the sun on her face. The white of her nightgown and hair, and the white sheets, and the sheets billowing on the rooftops, and the women fisting them down to gatherable size. The first drops hit, thick and splatting. She'd been up here once, not long ago, more or less hiding from her life, and she saw the young man standing across the street, standing smoking by a lamppost. Most of the time when she thought of him at all, she thought of him in motion. She thought of notched hands moving on her body, and dirt grained deep in his fingers. She thought of the turn of his shoulder and the way he looked at her over his clenched fist. She'd liked it when she saw him by the lamppost, looking at the building. Then she thought about it and didn't like it so much. But that was the only time she saw him there. The two children didn't want to go inside, but the rain was getting close. He'd been easy in a way, natural in a way. Not distant or totally unknown. At first she thought it might be nice to think of him as the young man, like a character in a coming-of-age novel. But she only thought of him in motion, and nameless, and non-fictional, a sort of rotary blur that hovered just off her right shoulder somewhere, the thing her brain condensed from all that pleasure and wet. She looked over the ledge and saw three girls playing jacks on a stoop across the street, seated on different steps, the girl with the ball still-bodied and hunched, only her hand working among the strewn jacks, frantically. And Clara could hear them calling threesies and kissies and interference, an argument breaking out, steely and clear. She didn't want more. She wanted less. This was the thing her husband couldn't understand. Solitude, distance, time, work. Something out there she needed to breathe. She took the laundry basket to the door and left it just inside. The surrounding rooftops were just about empty now, and the yowl of the alley lines had stopped. Even from this height, she could hear the rapping sound. A woman rapped a penny on the window, calling her child in from play. Then the rain came hard. Clara picked up her daughter and scooped the blanket under her arm and took the other child by the hand, and they ran, laughing, across the roof under racing skies. At dinner, she told him she'd been selfish.
"I don't think that's true," he said.
He tore a length of crusty bread in two, a thing he did ritually and with such depth of dependable habit that she couldn't imagine him getting through a full meal, all the switches and intervals and hand movements without this crucial flourish. The painting's a waste. I'm not getting anywhere. We'll put Teresa in that room. Give it time, he said. And anyway, where do you expect to get with it? Do it for the day-to-day satisfaction, for the way it fills out the day. She had a small print of a Whistler, the famous mother, and she hung it in a corner of the spare room, because she thought it was generally unlooked at, and because she liked the formal balances and truthful, muted colors, and because the picture was so clashingly modern. The seated woman in mob cap and commodious dark dress, a figure lifted out of her time into the abstract arrangements of the 20th century, long before she was ready, it seemed. But Clara also liked looking right through the tonal components, the high theory of color, the theory of paint itself, perhaps, looking into the depths of the picture at the mother, the woman, the mother herself, the anecdotal aspect of a woman in a chair, thinking, and immensely interesting she was. So Quaker prim and still, far away seeming, but only because she was lost, Clara thought, in memory, caught in the midst of a memory trance, a strong and elegiac presence, despite the painter's, the son's, doctrinal priorities. No, we'll do something with the room. That's what I ought to be doing, getting this place in some kind of livable shape. We have the front room to do, he said. We have the front room, which is still a kind of no man's land. I'll do the front room, then I'll do the spare room. And I'll step up my own efforts. Head of the science department, I'll make this my goal. And we'll travel this summer to Spain or Italy, wherever you like, he said. She liked to watch him eat because he did it so deeply, handling and savoring things, handling utensils, chewing food thoroughly. The way he paused unpretentiously with the wine glass an inch from his lips, waiting, savoring, a sense of earth and our connection to it. That was Albert over a dish of inky squid. Earth and sea, and the way he looked at food in the plate, breathing it all in before he even touched a fork. To Spain, she said. Madrid, the Prado. And she laughed a little coldly, with the hollow tone she used when she was punishing herself. I want to look at pictures till I drop. Then she saw him, on the street with a friend, veering toward an Army-Navy store. And she stopped and stood right there, stationed in his path, and he nearly walked into her before he saw who it was. And he stopped and showed only the thinnest surprise. And his friend stopped. And then she went around them and crossed the street. The next day he was standing by the lamppost when she looked out the window. She was putting up new curtains in the front room, and he was standing there smoking. A railway express truck passed between them. Then he looked up and saw her. He flicked the cigarette and walked across the street. She threw down the mattress. Nick watched her and pulled his shirt over his head. Then he watched her again. She stood there with her head down, like she was trying to remember something. And then she undid a button at the side of her skirt. She didn't finish her kisses. This was interesting and a little puzzling, unlike last time when they kissed nearly into old age. The way she broke off now and looked away, just when he thought a kiss was getting her warm and soft, and the way she looked when she did this, ripping away hurt, almost. And he was surprised at how different she looked. Not what he remembered from last time, but paler, maybe, hands weightless and drained, these white things floating past, and eyes that bugged out a little, and seemed to see things he didn't know were there. But the eyes also looked away, and that was the same, and the twisty smile, the little turn at the end of the mouth. Some things the same. The tits the same, the ass and tits and bush, and the slub of folded tongue when he kissed her. Looks that he couldn't figure out what they were supposed to mean. And the other smile, where she smiled privately at the two of them together, or whatever she was smiling at, smiling to herself like it was 3 days later, after the fact, and she was walking down an aisle at the A&P, thinking what they'd done. But it wasn't 3 days after the fact. It was still the fact. And she had his balls in her hand, squeezing slightly. A naked woman was amazing. He'd never seen it this way, in full light, without half-off clothes or a beach blanket across the lap, or sex in a dark car. This was her whole body, naked in light, standing and lying, and front and back, and open and showing, and then different when she walked across the room. All these ways, and walking toward him, too, and different when she walked, surer than he was, unclunky and smooth-moving, with parts that didn't bounce. She knew how to be naked. She looked like she'd been raised naked in this room. A skinny girl when she was a girl, probably, and skinny in a certain way, with a little bulgy belly and ashamed of her feet, but grown out of shyness and wrong proportions now. And being married, of course, used to being seen. And she didn't have curves and swerves, but was good-looking naked, and stuck to him when they fucked, like a thing fighting for light, a great, wet, papery moth. He took her stocking off the floor and fitted it over his head. She smiled and looked away, and seemed to want to say something, and then changed her mind. He jammed it down so he was looking out at her more or less through the heel of the stocking. He pantomimed pulling a gun out of a shoulder holster and pointed it at her. "Everything you own, mine or die." "It's hard to be serious about this, considering what you look like." "Hey, lady, this is what they do."
"Hold-ups, you mean?"
"That's right. But I have to say, they must need money pretty bad to wear this on their face."
"Well, it's used. They don't wear used stockings, do they?"
"I don't think these guys are finicky. They wear whatever's lying around."
"I have to admit, you're a changed man."
"You think you'd recognize me if I came in the house and I was standing here in this mask?"
"No. But I wouldn't recognize you without the mask, either." He pulled off the mask and sat on the mattress. She went to get some water, and he watched her walk out of the room, the way her ass barely jounced. And he held the stocking around his dick, and then tossed it away. The warm, fusty sort of slightly tired smell, the nylon cling of the odor still in his face, sad, tired, day-old, hers, and close to him. And something he knew about her that made her less strange. But she was still strange. She was something you didn't want to tell your friends about, and that was strange. And she was something you didn't have to tell yourself was really happening. It just happened. It happened, bang, and that was it. With Whistler's fucking mother hanging on the wall. He watched her come into the room. He said, "You know, my brother, when he was a little kid, he was somewhere watching a girl taking a pee. A small girl that was a neighbor's kid, probably. And she dropped her drawers and wiggled up onto the seat and had herself a pee. And my brother's watching this. And then he goes out to a room full of grown-ups, as I later heard the story. And he waits for him to stop talking. And then they finally stop talking, and they look at him, and he says, 'Mary Feely has no birdie.'" She handed him the glass. It was one of the longest speeches he'd ever made, Nick, not counting jokes he sometimes told. Then she reached for his bunched pants on the floor and felt in the pockets for a pack of cigarettes. They sat on the mattress, knees touching, smoking and sharing the water. "You know why I smoke Old Golds? I wouldn't tell this to just anybody." "Bullshit.
Why?" she said. "That's a cigarette they used to sponsor the Dodgers on the radio. Old Gold. We're tobacco men, not medicine men. The Dodgers were my team. Were. Not anymore."
"This is a big, privileged secret you're telling me."
"That's right. Now you have to tell me one of your secrets. Could be big, could be small."
"What's your name?"
"Nick." "Nick,
You can't come here anymore. It's too completely crazy. No more, okay? We did it, and now we have to stop doing it.
We can do it somewhere else, he said.
Nowhere else, no. I don't think so. Never mind the body. He's never looked at a woman's face so closely. How he thinks he knows who she is from her face, what she eats and how she sleeps, from the look-away smile and the uncombed hair, the hair over the right eye, how her face becomes everything she is that he can't put into words.
Nick Shea,
he said with a little stab in it, a touch of vengeful intent. Because she knew about the chess lessons, of course, and would recognize Maddie's last name, and would know Nick was the older brother, and would feel the close-knit danger of the thing. But she didn't seem to give a damn. The way he didn't give a damn that she was someone he knew's wife. She didn't care that he was someone's brother.
Then I might as well, he said.
Yes, I think it's time. He picked up the pants and got dressed, and left her naked on the mattress, seated sort of leaning to one side, legs together and bent, blowing smoke away from her face with the hand that held the cigarette. And he didn't even think of looking back. Chapter 7 Rosemary sat in the law office over the bakery, filing documents in an old cabinet, and her boss came in, Mr. Imperato, returned from a rare morning at the criminal courts. He was a shambling man who told jokes expertly, who rose to the occasion of a joke. He was bald, flat-footed, and carelessly dressed, and he was forgetful in his work sometimes, but when there was a joke to tell, he heard the music of the spheres. He never botched a punchline or missed a pause. He did voices and accents, men, women, talking birds, unfalteringly, a quickness rising to his eyes.
"Smell the bread," he said.
"That's the trouble with being over a bakery. I keep buying bread. My boys can't keep up."
"What'd you buy?"
"It's for dinner."
"Show me. Is it round or long?"
"Last time, remember what you did to my bread? It's dinner bread. Get away."
4 or 5 years ago, Mr. Imperato hired a private investigator on her behalf to try to locate Jimmy. The biggest secret of her life, a thing no one knew but the lawyer and the investigator. When nothing came of the effort, Mr. Imperato paid the man himself and told her she could do some clerical work to settle her fee. She'd been working here ever since, and he never deducted the fee from her salary because he needed someone, he said, to listen to his jokes.
"I'm buying us a bigger fan."
"I think we need it," she said.
"I got one for home. The kids sit in front of it sometimes. The TV is on the blink. I tell Anna they're watching the fan."
"I don't want TV in my house."
"You have to have it," he said.
"I don't want it."
"The kids want it."
"Maddie wants it. He goes upstairs to a neighbor and watches wrestling."
"I never miss the wrestling if I can help it." "You have to have it. The kids have to have it. It's the one thing you have to have."
When she went home with her bread, she climbed past her floor, going up the worn steps, seeing laundry hang outside the smutty stairway windows, because there was a thing she wanted to talk about with Mrs. Graziani up on the top floor. Carmela put out a coffee ring and made coffee, and they sat in the kitchen.
"How do you climb these steps every day?"
3, 4 times," Carmela said. "I know every step by name. I have names for the steps."
"And Mickey's feeling better since the operation?"
"If you could call it feeling better. He's the same as he always was. I don't know if that's better. Because these men, all they want to do is sit in a room playing cards for 17 hours they can play. Cards till they drop."
"But he had a real scare. If he can play cards, more power to him. You nearly lost him."
"I don't think I could lose him if I went to China," the woman said.
Rosemary usually felt better after a visit with Carmela. The woman had a running argument with men. Not just the husband and the sad son, Cosmo, but men everywhere. And even if Rosemary agreed with her only 2% of the time, she still felt cleaner somehow, purged like confession, having a cup of coffee with Carmela. I wanted to ask, did you hear about the woman at 607, the grandmother?
There's nothing to hear, Carmela said.
And she made a gesture, the hand that sweeps under the chin, a sign that meant this is not a story we're obliged to take seriously. The nothing sign. A very dismissive gesture, as Rosemary understood these things.
So you don't think? If I thought there was anything to it, I'd be the first to go over there and wait for him to appear and get down on my hands and knees to thank God for this miracle.
The woman at 607, saying her rosary in the basement room of the narrow, shingled house occupied by two families and two grandparents, looked up from her beads and saw a saint standing in the doorway, Saint Anthony. And Rosemary needed guidance in this matter, a sense of how much acceptance she should be willing to risk. Carmela put 4 spoonfuls of sugar in her coffee.
You know what I say, Rose? Domani metin. In other words, sure, tomorrow morning, here he comes again, this time with an angel blowing a trumpet.
This reaction was a letdown. For all her endless skepticism, Carmela was a frequent figure at early morning mass, and Rosemary wanted her to take the story more seriously, or to concede the grandmother's credentials, at least, long periods of prayer with a number of other old women, all in grave clothes, reciting the mysteries. Carmela told her for the 12th time to get out and see people.
You're still young, Rose.
I'm not so young. Don't argue with me. You need to spend less time at home and more time making friends. You give your whole life to those two boys. This Nicky, I hate to say it.
Then don't say it.
I hate to say it, Rose.
Don't say it.
This boy has got, I don't know what, written all over him. You know exactly what I mean.
He works hard. He hands over his money without a complaint.
The other one, I don't know.
If you don't know, Carmela.
I don't know, Rose, the other one, but it's Nicky I'm watching. I watch this boy.
That's funny, because you know what? I don't watch him. He gets up at the crack of dawn, he goes to work, he gives me his money, he gives me his pay envelope. Plus, I don't hear a word of complaint.
The mother's always the last to know.
He grew up fast, Nicky. He's a man now. He's more responsible than someone 10 years older. He grew up like lightning, this boy.
I'm sorry, Rose, but him I would watch.
Carmela's son had spent a year in the basket-weaving class, and another year in remedial reading, and a third year falling down a flight of stairs and recovering in bed, 3 meals a day in bed, and he lived with his grandparents now upstate. And she tells me she's worried about mine?
No, it was not the average satisfying visit with the woman on the top floor. And in the days that followed, warm days and cool evenings, the water truck spraying the streets and dirt and grit running in the gutters. There were many days when Rosemary walked past the narrow house, 607, and thought about the old woman, Bettina, saying the rosary in the basement room with her friends, the 5 joyful mysteries, Mondays and Thursdays, the 5 sorrowful mysteries, Tuesdays and Fridays, the 5 glorious mysteries, and so on. But then again, they probably didn't follow a set routine. No, they wouldn't, these women. Because there were women like that who wore monk's robes on the Feast of St. Anthony. Women and children both. Brown robes and bare feet, the statue bobbing above them. And it was amazing and strange and impressive, Rosemary thought. And women like that would say their prayers without regard for schedules. She was too shy to knock on the door, but she liked to think of the women sitting around the table, big beads, the Our Father, little beads, the Hail Mary. She didn't have time herself to do this every day. She had her own form of beadwork. She had the frame and the material pinned to the edges of the frame, and the needle with the wood handle that she used to string the beads onto the material, iridescent beads to decorate a dress, and she never really wondered who would wear it. She was too shy to talk to the grandmother, who spoke no English anyway. 35 years in this country and not 3 words of English.
But this was a mark of her faith, in a way, an indication of what truly mattered. What mattered were the mysteries, not the language in which you said them. The fresh air inspector stood on the corner nearly every day, three or four or five men, and Rosemary walked past the narrow house and thought about the thing that supposedly happened there. Sometimes faith needs a sign. There are times when you want to stop working at faith and just be washed in a blowing wind that tells you everything. Maybe, like, for an eighth of a second, she thought I smacked my lips, or I clicked my tongue at her. Then what? Then she understood I had food in my teeth and I was wedging it out, the way you wedge it out with the tongue. But she looked at me, and she saw who it was, and she decided she'd rather be insulted. I can understand this. You can understand this. I can understand this, because even if you didn't insult her, you could have. I didn't. But I could have. This is what you're saying? I know you 20 years, and you could have. Just so I understand. I didn't, but I could have. That's right. Because you, I could believe it. But I didn't. But you could have. Regardless, I was wedging food. Regardless, Jesus walked on water, because you could have. So this is where you're taking us. Where am I taking us? To where I have to say something. And you know what I have to say? And I say it to you and your sister, the both of yous. Be careful. You're going to hear this very good. To you, but mostly to your sister. Be careful, Anthony. I fuck you in your heart, you fucker. Anthony, but what a mistake you're making. You and your sister, I'll fuck you in your heart. Who I know 20 years. And your mother, for good measure. Who he thinks I'm going to listen to this from a hard-on like him? And your mother, he said. A kid went by with a baseball glove hooked to his belt, eating a mellow roll. The longshoreman stood across the street with that massive mustachioed head of his, a Whalio off the boat about a year ago, works the Jersey docks, strong as a Mack truck. Two guys pushed a car that had no one in it. Nick stood in front of the grocery eating a hero sandwich and holding a beer that Donato's wife had sold him, concealed in a paper bag. The fresh air inspectors. Sammy Bones, who ran on the field during a game at the polo grounds so he could be seen on TV, except nobody he knew was watching. And he's been arrabbiato ever since, like mad dog angry. A girl in her confirmation outfit. A white dress and stockings and white shoes, and wearing red ribbons in her hair, and carrying white flowers in crinkly red cellophane. Juju came by and took the sandwich out of Nick's hand and looked inside. The old man on the stoop across the street, who spreads his handkerchief dainty on the top step, and then sits and fills his pipe with cigarette tobacco and the shreddings of a crumbled De Noble cigar, the perennial Guinea stinker, and whatever else he can find that doesn't belong in a pipe. You serious about these weights? I'm doing bench presses, where my mother grabs the bar when I yell. Supine presses, Juju said in a slightly snobbish tone. How many bites are you going to take out of my sandwich? I'm doing a whole program. You should come over. Hey, I work, remember? I got 7-Up I lift all day long. That's not a program, Juju said. I'd rather die than lift weights. See, now that's an attitude where you're only showing your ignorance of the subject. I'd rather die the death of 1,000 cuts. Show your ignorance. I'd rather be ignorant. Look over there, the one in the yellow blouse. That's a 36D. What, you measured? What kind of measured? I have a trained eye. You can tell a D cup from a C cup from this distance? I'd rather eat sheep stomach than lift weights, Nick told him. The super's wife, looking peacefully out the window at 6:10, called Sister Katie. So when she got screaming, raging, drunk about once a month, the kids chanted up to her, "Sing it, Sister Katie!" She sells you beer on Sunday, before 1 o'clock? What kind of beer? This is root beer.
A boy in a white suit with a red tie and a red armband, and his hair plastered down, trying to wriggle out of the grip of his mother, who's swinging her handbag at his head.
"What's your confirmation name?"
"Never you fucking mind," Juju said.
First the close air of the long stairway, and the metallic taste of the air, and the thick, distant stir of men's voices on a busy night, the roil of muddy voices, and the smoke of the big room, and a ball game on TV, and a player softly chalking his stick, looking like a soldier in some old eccentric war, and the beautiful numbered balls and green bays, and dreamy prowl of a shooter on a run, and the endless, caroming clack of the balls hitting, the touch sounds of the cue, the balls, the cushions, the slap of the pocket drop. That night, Nick shot a game with George the waiter. George parked cars at the racetrack on his nights off from the restaurant, and he told stories about the cars he parked, about flooring the pedal and slamming the brake that sounded like dirty jokes, the chrome and upholstery and handling, all tits and ass. Nick felt a little wary of George since the episode of the needle. He felt cut off in a way, less free and easy. But George never referred to the thing and didn't even seem to remember. Still, he felt he'd lost some standing with George, showing shock and confusion that way. Nick looked up from the shot he was lining up. There was something in George's face that made him follow the man's line of sight to the other end of the room.
"Who's that?"
"You don't know him?"
Mike stood talking to a man near the counter, heavy set, in a too-tight jacket, two-toned, over an open-collar shirt.
"Take your shot," George said. He called Seven on the side.
"That's Mario Bottolato,"
George said. He made the shot.
"Not bad," George said. "You know this name?"
He wasn't sure, but shook his head.
"It's a name, over the years, that's been connected to that particular life."
Nick moved, crouched, to the far end of the table, studying his next shot.
"Understand what I'm saying? Father, uncles, cousins, brothers.
That particular life.
You're never going to bank the four. You should be looking anywhere but the four," George said. "People in that life."
"That life," Nick said.
"Mala vita. Who once they're in for good."
Nick glanced at the man in question. 40 years old, maybe. Thick and packed. A thickness of body that had no rolling or sagging, but was hard, packed. Built on other men's lesser luck. On the way, an unfortunate occurrence across town makes you stronger.
"You should be looking at the two ball, meanwhile. The four is not your shot, Nicky."
"The two ball?
Madame, what do I have to do? Send an engraved invitation?"
"That life," Nick said.
"That particular life. Under the surface of ordinary things. And organized so it makes more sense in a way, if you understand what I mean. It makes more sense than the horseshit life the rest of us live."
Nick studied the table some more.
"So is this the man who had walls, you know, put on ice?"
"What do I know? I don't know. I don't want to know. I don't even want to talk about it no more."
"No more, no more.
Take your shot," George said.
Mario Bottolato. Maybe he knew this name from somewhere. They shot a couple of games, and George gave him hints and tips. And a guy at the next table was singing to the tune of a popular song.
"Don't know why I got lipstick on my fly, sloppy blowjob."
"It's almost beach weather, George."
"This makes you happy? I hate the beach. I used to work at the beach."
"Don't tell me lifeguard. I pity the drowning child."
"Wise guy. I used to sell ice cream. This was years ago. 90 degrees with a cooler on my back that felt like 1,000 pounds.
"They still have those guys."
"We had to wear sun helmets, like Africa."
"They still wear them."
"I never want to see another beach."
"You want the nine ball here. Look, it's set up beautiful.
It was time for George to get back to the restaurant. There was a gin rummy game going, and Nick stood and looked and got bored and called the dog and took it for a walk. He stood in Mussolini Park while the dog went scratching at patches of dirt. He watched a tow truck go by, doing 60 easy, the driver taking the traffic circle like a rodeo rider, slanted to jump. A guy named Grasso came up to him. They were in the same shop class once, and he pointed at two guys diagonally across the street, at the luncheonette, at the outside counter, standing eating something, black guys, both of them with team jackets.
They come out of the bowling alley. Then they go over to the window and order whatever they order. Ever seen them before? Here? They never been here.
The two guys put their paper cups back on the counter and walked toward Third Avenue. And Nick and Grasso followed, with the dog trailing. The guys knew there was someone behind them. Not that they turned, but Nick saw the way they stopped talking and the way their stride seemed maybe to tighten a little.
What's it say on the jackets? Hawks, I think. Ever hear of them?
Nick said.
Never. Hawks? What fucking hawks? Plus, I don't think it's a team. I think it's a gang.
They went past the funeral home and walked a block and a half along Third Avenue, through the slatted shadows of the L, and then the two guys stopped and turned around. Nick and Grasso walked up to them.
Hawks? What's hawks?
Grasso said. They didn't answer. One guy ready, the other still thinking about it.
You live here? The hawks? Because I don't think I've seen any hawks before.
They didn't answer. The dog caught up to them and began to go nose-twitching around the feet of one of the guys.
It's better, you know, at night especially, if you stay where you belong. In the day, too,
Grasso said.
But at night especially, because otherwise people get the wrong idea.
The train passed over with a great staccato clatter, and they all waited until it was passed. But then the two guys didn't say anything.
I still don't know what's hawks. I act nice, but I don't hear no explanation.
Cars creeping around the L pillars when they made a turn, and Mike the dog sniffing at the guy's shoe, and the guy sort of flicking the shoe, doing a little foot jerk that made the dog back off. And Nick stepped up and punched him. A car stopped in the middle of a turn. Nick stepped up and hit the guy once, a fair-to-good shot that caught him on the temple when he tried to duck under. And this car came to a sudden stop, and four guys got out and left the doors hanging open of this car just stopped in the middle of the street. They were guys from the other pool room, Turk and his fuck-face friends. And one of the black guys started running, but the other one stood there and glared, six white guys and a brown dog more or less surrounding him. Nick half-smiled at Turk.
He kicked my dog, he said.
The one still here was the one he'd hit, and he was looking at Nick, glaring. And Nick shrugged and smiled, and the guy turned and walked away slowly. And the four other guys took a breath and hitched their pants and got back in the car. The doors closed, bangity-bang, and the car drove off. Grasso said,
"Fucking Turk. I know. He thinks he's king shit walking the earth. I know,"
Nick said.
"Where'd you get that animal? Lives at Mike's. I never seen an animal so ugly."
Nick faked a punch to the guy's head, and they walked back to the lighted streets with the roar of the L behind them. About a month later, the man was back in the pool room, standing at the counter late one night with Mike. They're eating baked ziti out of tin plates. Mike flashed the light over the table where Nick was playing. When Nick looked up, he said,
"Come over here."
Nick walked over with a self-conscious saunter, like he was about to meet his future father-in-law.
"Mario here, he wants to say something you should listen to. Mario knew your father just after the war. During the war and after the war."
Bottolato was standing with his back to the room, and Nick went around the counter, where Mike was standing, behind the counter, so he could face the man. They had glasses of wine, which Nick had never seen in here, and they had a canister of red pepper they passed back and forth, eating standing up, every forkful of ziti trailing long strands of mozzarella.
I knew your father, Jimmy. I liked Jimmy.
Nick could not fail to understand the consequence of the moment. A man of this particular life is going to talk to him about his father.
Mike told me. He said, Jimmy's son, he comes in here, Jimmy Costanza. I said, I haven't heard this name in a while. I liked Jimmy, I said.
And the consequence of the man himself, the thick hands and dark brows and thick hair, and the slightly flattened nose like a boxer's.
I said, what did I say? Jimmy had a talent, this guy. He's Mr. Invisible.
Nick couldn't fail to understand the weight of the occasion, but he was also wary of it. He was hesitant. He wanted to say something unsolemn, because anything about his father made him apprehensive.
The way I understand it from Mike, you think your father had no choice in the matter. How he left, how he disappeared. Somebody put him in a car, this is what you think, as his son is what happened to the man. And they drove him somewheres. But I have to tell you one thing.
Bartolotto took a sip of wine from the low, squarish glass.
Nothing could have been done to your father without me knowing about it. I have to tell you this. I would have known. And even if I don't know beforehand, which isn't about to happen, but even if it did, then I find out later. I would have heard. You understand what I'm saying? It's not possible this could happen without me knowing about it sooner or later.
The warm smell of food was making Nick hungry, and he couldn't help wondering how the food could be carried here from a restaurant still steaming hot.
I liked your father. I don't think Jimmy had serious enemies. He owed money, so what? If somebody owes you money, you work out an arrangement. There are ways to do these things where you use simple business methods, the way Mike runs a business, the way a haberdasher runs a business. You buy a suit, you pay so much down, so much a month. You buy a car, and so forth.
The man looked at Nick while he spoke. He didn't sound superior or offhand. He wanted to make an honest connection and get his point across.
Jimmy was not in a position where he could offend somebody so bad that they would go out of their ways to do something. No disrespect, but he was penny-ante. He had a very small operation he was running. Made the rounds of the small bettors. Mostly very small, these bets. This is what he did. Factory sweepers and so forth. You have to understand, Jimmy was not in the position to be threatened by serious people.
Nick watched him take a bite of food. He could not help feeling grateful. The man stood there and talked to him. The man took time to tell him something he thought would settle the matter in Nick's own mind.
I appreciate, he said.
I liked your father. And I know what it's like myself to lose a father at an early age. From cancer, this was.
You taking the time, I appreciate.
Forget about it. Go finish your game, the man said.
Nick still had the pool stick in his hand. He gestured toward the light over the table.
Mike, tell me. You're not going to charge me for the time you guys spent eating ziti.
The men enjoyed that.
He went back to the table and finished the game with Stevie and Ray. They wanted to know what he'd been talking about with the guys at the counter. He thought of a half-assed joke, but then said nothing. He was grateful for the time, genuinely. But he didn't think he had to accept the logic of the argument. The logic, he decided, did not impress him. They played cards down there, pinochle, and drank homemade wine in the room under the shoemaker's shop, off the dim passageway that led out to the yards. Bronzini looked on, sitting in when someone left, but otherwise a kibitzer, unmeddlesome, content to savor the company and try the wine. Sometimes good, sometimes over-fermented, better used to spike a salad. He was in a hurry to be an old man, Clara told him. Why else sit here with these elders of the streets, some of them nearly twice his age, spending whole afternoons in argument and aimless talk? Outside in the deep, slow swelter,
Cats were asleep in the shade, and people keeping to the sides of the building, if they were out at all, moving dazed in the unexpected heat. Down here in the basement room, it was dry and quiet and stone cool. Quiet except for the voices, of course. And he liked the voices, loud, crude, funny, often powerfully opinionated. All speechmakers, these men. Actors, declaimers, masters of insult, reaching for some moment of transcendence. John the Super loosed a bullfrog fart. He told them about the garbage he used to handle when he worked as a janitor downtown, temporary, in a large apartment building. Elevators, doormen, dry cleaning delivered, taxis left and right. Managi a la America. This goddamn country has garbage you can eat. Garbage that's better to eat than the food on the table in other countries. They have garbage here you can furnish your house and feed your kids. They played and bid and made sissing noises to acknowledge the bountiful folly of clothes and the garbage that are good enough to wear. Albert told them about the ancient Mayans. These people did not bury their dead with gleaming jewelry and other valuable objects. They used old broken things. They put cracked vases in with the dead, or chipped cups and tarnished bracelets. They used the dead as a convenient means of garbage disposal. This story satisfied the card players. It was very satisfactory. Disrespect for the dead was a nice, cruel, satisfying joke, especially to men of a certain age. A joke on the dead was a beautiful joke, a joke with balls. Albert felt isolated here in the safest of ways. The slap of the cards, the men making theatrical bids, the wine seeping into his system. And he knew finally why there was something familiar about these lost afternoons under the shoemakers. Like childhood, he thought. Those bedridden days when he was islanded in sheets and pillows, surrounded by books, by chess pieces, deliciously sick at times, a fever that sent him inward, sea sweats and dreams with runny colors, lonely but not unhappy, the room a world, the safe place of imagination. Liguri didn't take wine anymore, the printer, because he had a liver condition. He talked about the strolling musicians who used to come around, a fiddler and a trumpet player, and how people wrapped coins in paper and threw them from the windows. "Quanta sold," his wife used to say. "How much is it going to cost me to listen to this caffone play his fiddle?" But they didn't come around anymore. They had liver conditions or half a stomach between them, or the noise of traffic, Albert said, made music futile. The men spoke mostly English, but used the dialect when an idea needed a push or shove into a more familiar place. And odd how Albert, barely nearing 40, could feel his old manness within him, here in particular, as the voices took him back to earliest memory. The same slurred words, the dropped vowels, the vulgate, so that English was the sound of the present, and Italian took him backwards, the merest intonation, a language marked inexhaustibly by the past. Someone was evicted, put out on the street. Chairs, tables, bed, right around the corner. "The bed," John said, the super. "Frame, spring, mattress, pillows, out on the sidewalk." Porca miseria. What a wretchedness it was. What a complete humiliation of the spirit. You're like a museum of poverty. People walk by and look. The bed, the plates and glasses, the suitcase with your clothes, a pair of old shoes and a paper bag. Imagine shoes. And they walk by and look. Who says this? Who says that? Who sits in a chair? Who points from a car? They should be ashamed to look. A man's shoes on the sidewalk. There was always the neighborhood, and who was leaving and who was moving in, showing up on the fringes. Tizoons. A word Albert wished they wouldn't use, a southern dialect word, a corruption, a slur, an invective, from Tizzo, he assumed, a firebrand or smoldering coal, and broadened to human dimensions in Tizzone d'Inferno, scoundrel, villain.
But the word they used suggested a hellishness, a fiendishness, that made it more unspeakable, in a way, than nigger. But they spoke it, of course, these men, these immigrants or sons of immigrants, the hordes who threatened society's peaceful sleep, who were always showing up and moving in. Tizum. They masked the word. They narrowed their eyes and barely moved their lips. But they spoke it, they half-hissed the word, in a way that made Albert wish he hadn't heard. Spadafora told them about the washing machine that was automatic, where the woman sets a control and walks out the door, and the machine washes, rinses, spins, dries, shuts off, everything automatic. They shook their heads and made sissing noises and muttered casual curses, baffled at their luck in being here, amazed and confused, searching a way to train their skepticism on the wonders that unfolded daily. The wine was not so drinkable this time. It was the shoemaker's own wine, Guido, and this was not wine weather anyway. And Albert wanted to be more responsible. He wanted to be a dry, wise soul, Heraclitus, less slipshod and indecisive, more willing to see into the core of a complicated matter. He needed to take a leak, and the super told him there was a utility sink he could use, and gave him directions through the maze of passages. He went past storage rooms and empty garbage cans. Then he came out into a courtyard and saw the door the super had described and went into the next building. For a long time he wanted to believe that she had ambitions on his behalf. But now he wasn't sure of this. He thought she wanted him to campaign for department head, for assistant principal. Make the moves, play the game, buy a car, buy a house. And he thought these ambitions were going unfulfilled, which made her angry and distant at times. But now he wasn't sure. He walked through the cellarways under rows of copper piping. He found the utility closet and peed in the sink. His childhood was back there, in the voices of his mother and father, guarded, suspicious, scared at times, and in the sissing noises they made to mark distrust of the unknown world around them. He heard a radio playing round the next bend, and decided to follow the sound, music, sweetness, strings, his head clear and his bladder empty, the ever-gregarious Albert curious to see what sort of company he might encounter here. He turned the corner and stopped next to a discarded table with a missing leg. George Manza. George the waiter sat in a chair in a shabby room. There was something about him. He wasn't dozing or deep thinking, but there was something. He was awake, but unresponsive, and there was something that kept Albert from speaking. He stood in the doorway watching. The room had a certain anonymous squalor. It was a room you could probably spend some time in without registering clearly what was in there. A strew of lost and found, and miscellaneous things, and anonymous faded colors, and things that were stored here, not for future use, but because they had to go somewhere. George sat in profile, hunched a little, and breathing through his nose, slow breathing, drawing in and letting out at long intervals, a small life in every breath. The door was ajar, and Albert watched. There was only a 3-inch space between the door and the jamb, 3-4 inches only, but this was enough to see whatever there was to see. He didn't know exactly what this was. The man directed a dead stare at the facing wall. There was something so stark about him that Albert thought he had no right to look. He hadn't seen George in several months, or longer even, and George looked different, thinner, smaller, severe. Sitting under a radio on a shelf, the music so foreign to the figure of the man that Albert felt a need to turn it off. But he stayed where he was in the dim passage. He was seeing something completely concealed, an unwhisperable thing under the standoff man, the taciturn man hard to befriend. He felt guilty looking into the room, and guilty again moving away, backing away. But he backed away quietly and turned toward the light of a dangling bulb. He went down the wrong passage and into a narrower place, pipes running horizontally along the walls and a cloacal stink beginning to emerge. He walked over a grated drain where the smell was profound, a sorrowful human sewage, and it took him a while to find a door that led outside. Mike the Book had a flourish he did with his hand. It was broad and Roman, a flat hand moving parallel to the earth as a gesture of burial, or a way of writing fini to something significant. That night, Albert and Clara made love in the moonlight. It was sweet and easy and seemingly endless, a love so lost to time he felt they'd found a spirit life that would protect them from human flaw. With a small fan buzzing in the corner, and an aria drifting from a radio on a fire escape somewhere. He wasn't sure who she was, lying next to him in the dark. But this was something they could overcome together. Chapter 8. Up on the roofs, the tar beaches, they put suntan oil on their arms and legs and sat on blankets wearing shorts, the girls did, or jeans rolled to the knees. And they oiled their faces and sat listening to a portable radio until the heat was too intense to bear, and then they sat a little longer. They sang the week's top songs along with the radio, down the list from 40, and they got the words, the pauses, the dips and swerves, every intonation point-blank perfect. But only the songs they liked, of course. The tar softened and fumed, and the heat beat down, and the green gnats stuck to their bodies. And across the way, the pigeon kid sent his birds into spiral flight with a bamboo pole, and waved a towel at times, and whistled like a traffic cop. And his flock mixed in midair with a rival flock from a roof 3 blocks away. 100 birded tumult and blur. And younger birds flew with the wrong flock and were captured and sometimes killed, dispatched within the rules by the rival flyer of the other roof. And after a while, the girls had to leave because the sun was just too smoking hot, singing lyrics as they rolled their blankets up. They took the bus out to the beach, and people kept crowding on, and Nick got jammed in the back with Gloria instead of Loretta. They stood hanging from the straps, and every time the bus turned or stopped, there was a certain amount of body contact that was unavoidable, except they could have avoided it. And Nick reacted deadpan, and Gloria smiled. And this was a ride that took approximately forever. Section 13 was the pickup section at the beach, but they put their blanket down at the first available space because they were here with each other. And the beach was just as crowded as the bus. Guys rode the shoulders of other guys and hand-fought the riders in shallow water. Blankets with radios, food, rented umbrellas, sand bodies crammed together, card players, sailor hats, suntan oil. Loretta came out of the water and he threw her a towel, the only towel they'd brought, 4 people, and he watched her stand above the blanket in a vast sand nation of blankets. The horseshoe beach stretching to a rock jetty in either direction. And he watched Loretta shake the water off her hair and finger-stick the towel in her ears. A guy stood on his hands before toppling into a blanket he didn't belong to, and there were looks and words and people brushing sand. Juju stood up to put oil on his body.
"Let them see you," Gloria said.
"The weightlifter," Loretta said.
"Show them your forearms, Juju."
"It's funny what you can do on a beach," Loretta said, "which if you did it on a street corner, they'd throw stones."
"Flex for them. They're watching,"
Gloria said. An ice cream vendor made his way among the blankets, wearing all white, his face gone pink in the high sun. And if you bought a 2-stick pop, you'd never get to the second half before it melted in your hand. Nick hit the water and went deep, and felt the shatter shock when he emerged, lungs tight and eyes salt-burned, the bracing change of worlds. Women removed the wet bathing suits of their children, with the kids wrapped in towels, and then dressed the kids, underwear and all, still in towels, like writhing magic acts in the desert. Loretta was face down on the blanket, asleep, sand sticking to her back, and he rested on an elbow next to her, blowing softly on her shoulder. They had the rear seat of the bus to themselves on the ride back, the motor right below them, heat beating up, and they dozed on each other's shoulders, faces sun tight and eyes stinging slightly, tired, hungry, happy, the bus belching heat beneath them. He stood in the dark hallway and watched her.
"Gloria, you're so bad."
"I'm not bad. You're bad.
You're so bad. If I'm bad, what are you?"
"Gloria, come here, Gloria.
What do you want?"
"Come here a minute."
"What for come here? Come here for what?"
"You're a cunt, Gloria."
"What do you want?"
"You're a cunt, Gloria."
"Say something nice, Nicky."
She was smiling. He wasn't. "You're so bad. You're really bad."
"I'm bad? Who's bad?"
She was rolling her hips under his hands and smiling.
"You're a cunt in and out and up and down. You're an all-over cunt, through and through." "Try and say something nice for a change," she told him.
This ends Disc 25.